At times, I have to pinch myself to remember that I am in the Reagan 80s, not the Kennedy Johnson 60s.
I so, like, totally know what you mean, right? That's because here at Playback, we pinch ourselves so often that it's getting painful. I mean, really, all those pinches are starting to add up. But that's okay, because we're feeling the love in the Reagan 80s. On this Playback, we travel to March 1986 to hear the unusual story of this woman from Alabama.
Well, I've had some close calls, but I think the brush with death was the night that the elephant nearly sat on me.
Painful, cathartic, near-death experiences, plus a bonus track from singer Jonathan Richman.
If you've fallen in love, for one thing, you got a better crack at this stuff. Because I'm doing it sort of on another wavelength. Well,
I've got a new yeah, that kind of sums it up for us here at Playback. But I have to tell you, spring is in the air.
You know, spring has finally arrived in Fairbanks, Alaska, when the first car falls through the ice bridge on the Chena River. Now, that probably won't happen for a few weeks yet, since the ice there is nearly 3 feet thick. In the meantime, you'll find skiers, joggers, and dog mushers all vying for a spot on the windy, frozen waterway. Fairbanksons may have to wait for the birch blossoms and chirping birds, but there is a hint of spring.
Indeed, there's quite a bit of sunshine. I think that's the biggest difference for everyone. It's just a little more light in the sky, and the days are getting longer.
Daylight. That's what really separates Alaska from the rest of the United States. For example, in Fairbanks today, the sun will be up for 12 and a half hours. That's more than anywhere in the lower 48. And it's picking up 7 to 8 minutes a day until the summer solstice, when the sun will be out for nearly 22 hours.
Leave your car by the side of the road in Washington's Skagit Valley. Walk into the field. The old barn in the distance, shedding red paint. The small farm buildings nearby, not painted at all, but bleached out silver gray. In the middle of the field, 200 trumpeter swans at rest, a shocking white against the mud and the young green winter wheat. The swans fly north in this season and complain now that their rest is disturbed. Seattle is 60 miles away to the south.
Piles of fresh king salmon and buckets of bright yellow daffodils down at the Pike Place Market. Hundreds of sailboats out on Puget Sound. And all across this city, people bent over in their gardens. Sure signs that Seattle is emerging from its gray, drizzly winter.
Here goes the ivy. Oops, look, there's a lily that my wife planted. One weak little lily trying to survive amongst all this accumulation. Oh, look, there's another one.
The birds sing louder and earlier in the springtime on Billy Joe West's farm just outside Kansas City, and there's planting and feeding to be done. But Billy Joe really knows spring has come when he's up 18 hours for days on end delivering new lambs and calves.
In New England, you are tired of snow. A March snowstorm bends down the spirit, and April snow can make you snap. There's no gardening here yet, but a harvest, maple sugar.
In New England, in the warm days that straddle the solstice, sap rises in the maple. It takes warm days and cold nights to make the sap run.
You know, leave it to NPR to prominently feature the sound of sap slowly dripping into a bucket. Which just proves that hope springs eternal, like our next commentator, Michael Harrington. He believed that the Reagan Revolution would be overthrown by a feisty crop of Democrats, and that only a little bit of money would fund the Nicaraguan Contras, not the actual buckets of illegal cash that were funneled to the Contras from sales of arms to Iran. By the way, we found out about that deal in November of 1986. But here's Mr. Harrington.
I have no doubt that Ronald Reagan will get some military aid for the Contras. And yet, I am encouraged by the fact that the House voted him down and that 47 senators stood up against his dangerous proposal. Perhaps that is because I remember the 50s. The president deliberately provoked a military confrontation with Libya and hyped up a Nicaraguan incursion into Honduras. and he attacked all those who opposed him as agents of communism and, in effect, enemies of their own country. When such charges were made in the McCarthy era, the Democrats capitulated in the most craven way. The low point in that process was the Anti-Communist Control Act, authored by Hubert Humphrey, perhaps the leading liberal in the Senate. It passed with one dissenting vote by Estes Kefauver of Tennessee. More broadly, in the Eisenhower years, the media were totally focused on the non-fact of the total affluence of American society. Yet in recent weeks, I have seen dramatic television reports on the agricultural depression and the children of poverty. At times, I have to pinch myself to remember that I am in the Reagan 80s, not the Kennedy-Johnson 60s. And that is not simply an impression, for the polls show a majority of the people who admire Ronald Reagan disagree with him on almost every major issue. I repeat, I will not be at all surprised if the Democrats, including the liberals, make a compromise with Reagan's unconscionable militarism. But the fact that they fought him on the Contras, and that this culture cares about the homeless and the hungry, makes me think that we are not that far from a left turn into the future. In 1957, the idea of the 60s was an absurd dream, but it happened. And something like that may happen sooner than we think.
Well, something like that happened on and off for 2.5 more decades, which brings me to the next story about a group of unlucky amphibians.
In Britain, animal rights supporters are launching a campaign to save a forgotten victim of the nation's highways, the toad. British Fauna and Flora Preservation Society estimates that each year 20 tons of toads are squashed on the country's roads as they migrate to breeding grounds. The Society's Adrian Penrose says toad lovers are being urged to take to the streets to save these vulnerable amphibians.
We hope to enlist the help of volunteers who will stand by the roadside on toad patrols at night, armed with buckets, and they'll scoop up the toads and carry them across to the other side of the road and to safety.
What other plans do you have if this doesn't work?
Well, we've got a lot of evidence to suggest that it does work. We think we saved an awful lot of toads last year. We had groups of people out at night at these toad patrols up and down the country, and they seem to be doing a very good job. And the records of the number of toads being squashed, if you like, the massacres, certainly did not seem to be as many last year when we first tried this as in previous years.
Is the problem with the toads or with the drivers?
Well, most of the casualties occur about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night when drivers are coming out from the public houses and hotels, perhaps in a bit of a hurry to get home, and they're not quite as careful about the driving as they might be at other times of the day. That tends to be the peak time when all the toads get squashed, and we hope that the combination of the road sign and the volunteers helping the toads will really try and reduce the number of road casualties.
Does the sign say anything, or is it one of those international symbols?
It's one of our standard symbols over here. It's a red warning triangle, and inside there's a picture of the toad, a black symbol of the toad.
March 1986 was a period of continued political conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. NPR's Neil Conan was reporting in London at the time. He joined us in the studio recently to share the story of a particularly memorable reporting assignment.
I was based in London for a long time, and I would go a lot of the time back to Northern Ireland, which was in the middle of the Troubles, as they called it in those days. There was a demonstration at a place called Portadown, and this is one of those marches the Protestants have every year to mark the Protestant ascendancy. It was when the armies of William and Mary took over from the Catholic King James. Anyway, 1690, long time ago, but they have these marches every year. And this year, the authorities had decided, no, you can't march through the Catholic part of town for various reasons. They saw it as a civil rights violation, so they set up these barricades. They knew there would be a confrontation. Everybody knew exactly where the confrontation would be. So we're following the head of the march, these Protestant guys coming down, beating their drums, very colorful. It's the Orange Parade. And we knew that they're going to come to this barricade. And I get in absolutely perfect position. I'm there to get the guy saying, you know, the chairman of the police department, whatever it is, saying, you can go this far and no farther. You know, that's the piece of tape I really needed. So I get up there and I have got him right here. I've got the mic in a perfect position. And I look back to see where the head of the march is, and somebody rips the mic out of my hand. And I just assume that it's a TV cameraman, because it's the kind of thing those, you know, beasts would do. So I turn around and I grab it and I rip it right back. And then I realized it wasn't a TV cameraman. It was one of the demonstrators. That they were, in fact, back of me, beating up the media, who they held some objections to. If I'd known it was, you know, somebody who was, you know, willing to commit violence, I would have let him have it. You know, I wasn't going to risk my microphone to get beaten up, but I got my microphone back and was able then to just turn back and get the sound of, you can go this far and no farther, and then the sound of people being pummeled behind me. And it was just fortunate I'd gotten into exactly the right position. I was sort of in the penumbra of the police presence, and I was one of the people lucky enough not to get the crap kicked out of me that day.
There's a Renault car turned over on its side in flames and burning. It's not the only one. There's fires coming up from the other end of the street as well. And crowd moving through the area. Windows have been smashed. Glass doors kicked in.
Then a Protestant politician named George Seawright arrived. He's a Democratic Unionist assemblyman and counselor. This particular incident was happening right on the edge of a Catholic area, the market, what George Seawright calls a Republican area. I asked him what was going on.
Well, basically, they're protesting against the Anglo-Irish Agreement.
Turning cars over and smashing
windows? Well, I mean, that's the gateway into the Republican area, and if people are going to invade Republican areas, certainly they have my whole heart to support. I don't make any apology for that. I mean, only a fool believes that the Anglo-Irish Agreement is going to be brought down pacifistically. It's going to have to be brought down by violence. And that's the bottom line, and that's it.
So you support invading Republican areas?
Oh, absolutely. Always have done, and always will, hopefully.
That's the best way to bring about
political
change.
This particular rampage was over after about 20 minutes, but there were more serious incidents later in East Belfast, similar ones in Portadown, Enniskillen, Armagh. In Derry, Protestants fought Catholics for control of the main bridge into the city. In Lurgan, Protestants set fire to a clothing factory that tried to stay open today. Police trying to help Catholic workers escape were stoned. All across the province, Protestants set up roadblocks to stop many of those who wanted to go about their business. Many were in paramilitary uniforms, and the police reported widespread intimidation. There were also many who said that they were attacked and intimidated, while the police stood by and did nothing. There were blackouts in many areas as well, caused by Protestant workers at the power stations. Many schools were closed, most stores, offices, and factories as well. The Protestant politicians who called this strike condemned the violence and intimidation, but said that overall, this day of action was an overwhelming success. They did succeed in bringing the province to a standstill today, but the price may have been heavy. Many here believe that the politicians have effectively lost control of this campaign now, that hardliners in their own parties and shadowy workers' groups are running the show, with the paramilitaries, self-appointed militias, rapidly emerging as well. And as burning cars guttered out in the streets tonight, there was widespread conviction here that worse, and maybe much worse, will come in the weeks and months ahead. I'm Neil Conan, National Public Radio in Belfast.
And just like Mr. Neil Conan, our next guest, Miss Catherine Tucker Windham, was living life on the edge. Here's her story of the fickle hand of fate.
Well, I've had some close calls, as they say. Maybe the closest was when I was snatched off the railroad track as the freight train was about to get me. But I think the brush with death though I didn't realize it was such at the time, was the night that the elephant nearly sat on me. I was about, I guess, 7, 8 years old. And my mother and my cousin Tab had taken me to the circus. Now, circus didn't come to Thomasville. It was a little town. We got a few little circuses. But this one was in Grove Hill. That was the county seat, and it was 12 miles away, and they got most of the cultural events. Well, it was a mighty little circus, but it was exciting to me. Just one ring, had monkeys and ponies and an acrobat and a juggler and a couple of clowns and big elephant. We had front row seats. We got there early, and we were right on that little sawdust ring. The tent was full. And I'd enjoyed the whole performance, but the last act was to show the strength of this elephant. He was going to pull up a giant stake that was driven in the center of the ring there. So his trainer attached a chain to him and tied it to that stake, and he began to pull, and the stake wouldn't come up. And the elephant got angry about it, and the trainer lost control of him, and the elephant was rearing around there, pulling against that stake. And finally, he turned around so that his rear end was in our laps, we people sitting on the front row. I'd never seen an elephant that close up before. And I didn't realize that if that stake came up, that he was going to squash us, just sit right on us. But everybody else in that tent realized it. And somebody reached behind me, and they snatched me up and got me out of the way, and Mother and Tab scurried away. And when we got to safety, someone said, "Oh, weren't you just frightened to death, Miss Tucker?" And Mother said, "Well, no, I was not frightened so much as I was worried, because I knew very well that my husband would never claim our bodies if we were sat on by an elephant. It would be too humiliating."
So you figure after being nearly sat on by an elephant, things could only get better. Here's Bob Edwards talking to singer Jonathan Richman.
Yo, yo, yo!
By conventional standards, Jonathan Richman is not much of a singer or guitarist or composer. You won't find him playing large concert halls, and he doesn't record with any big-name labels. But Jonathan Richman and his band, the Modern Lovers, have acquired a large following of people attracted to the sentiment of his lyrics and his simple style, a style someone once called campfire soul.
To me, it's rock and roll. But the way we play it is like with the way you'd play it around a campfire, really. We don't use any amplifiers or anything. So campfire soul says it as good as anything else.
1, 2, 3.
When it smells like rain and the clouds are black, my raggy t-shirt be on my back. I wanna walk my bike to dig the rock and bang. I wanna hear that groove, I wanna feel that twang. Well, that cheap guitar, man, it's sounding thin. That saxophone sounds like the cat dragged it in. But I want it in my life, cause this kind of music is the kind I like.
When he was 19, Richman put together his first band, whose style reflected the influence of Richman's favorite rock band at the time, the Velvet Underground. For a while, it looked as though Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers might hit it big, but conflict with his record label caused Richman to turn to smaller labels. Finally, he was free to explore his own kind of rock and roll. Musically, his songs are unremarkable, but the lyrics are honest and straightforward. Richman says the directness of his songs makes some people uncomfortable.
The funny thing about me is I'm known most by the audience least likely to understand my music, which is college age. So the audience most likely to understand it, people over 40 and people under 14 and people under 17 and stuff, don't hear it much. Like when people are there, you know, in a school where they're trying to get cynical and get all philosophical, and then I come on, they try and analyze my stuff, And then they try and think maybe I'm being ironic or cute or all these things. So I stop them. Because it's no fun for me to do a show that way. So sometimes I say, look, this isn't what you think it is. Simple as that.
I mean, some people would take it as satire, maybe.
Right, maybe. Or maybe they don't even know. I hear this nervous laughter from college audiences that I don't hear from other audiences. You know, if you're going to laugh, really laugh. You know, but they're just kind of going, like, because they're not sure what everyone's supposed to think about it. I can feel them thinking. I can smell them thinking from the stage. And I say, look, forget it. This ain't cute like you think it is. This isn't what you think. So I just explain for a minute or two. I just try and say, oh, so they can go, oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I've got a new thing going now.
Jonathan, what's happening?
Well, I've got a new thing going now.
Jonathan, what's happening?
Well, it's sad like the it's all that I've got somebody to hold me. She holds me.
Why are those over 40 and under 17 most likely to understand?
If you've fallen in love, for one thing, you got a better crack at this stuff. If you haven't fallen in love, and you're saying that college age, it can be kind of rough, because what I'm doing is sort of on another wavelength there. It'll sound kind of... like, I can see why people laugh that nervous laugh, because they just don't, they haven't felt what I'm feeling. Or I'm not just in love with a person, in love with life, you know. That's why, also, before you've had the life taken out of you, you know, before it's beaten and kicked out of you too bad, maybe when you're a little kid you can understand it too.
I'm about 17, I guess. Yeah, I read what the calendar said. But I'm not about to drop dead. I just happened on the scene. And since I wake up in the morning and I love the world like a boy chasing his first girl, what do numbers mean? I'm about 17. Let's get to the program. Dang, dang,
new day. In love with life versus falling in love. It sounds, to a lot of people, probably very old-fashioned.
Yeah, that's what I mean. There are some people who are going to have a hard time understanding what I'm trying to do. If it sounds old-fashioned, they're going to have a hard time with this stuff I'm into.
And since I still want to laugh, and I still want to go, and since you still can't beat me for rock and roll, what do numbers mean? I'm about 17.
Songs are very optimistic, very hopeful.
I disagree with you, sir. I don't think they are optimistic. I think they're realistic.
How so?
Because they tell about life the way I see it, period. And I don't try and color it any other way than the way I see it. It ain't optimistic. It's strictly my songs, my love songs are just the facts.
Well, some boys don't believe you can have much fun. And that's why you ought to know about this love of mine. Sticking with one girl as their only one. And that's why they ought to know about this love I have. I want them to throw me a glance. Give me a little chance. I'll sing them firstly a song about a real romance. I knew I was gonna wait for her when I didn't have a sign. And that's why you wanna know about this love of mine.
Who do you want to reach?
A little bit of everyone. I'd like to play county fair type audiences. I'd like to play family shows. I'd like to play outside in the afternoon, say in a plaza. If I had my druthers, I would play like theater matinees with popcorn and stuff like that, and little eight-year-olds running around, and this is family entertainment. This is like it's stuff that would happen around a campfire. That campfire soul thing really works pretty good. It's the kind of stuff that if you're out in somewhere in the woods or by the beach, what are people going to do if they don't have much stuff? Someone might juggle something, do acrobatics, people pick up guitars and play them, they'll go swimming, surfing. You know what I mean? It's just for hanging around.
Jonathan Richman and his band, The Modern Lovers, have a new album coming out next month entitled
It's time for Jonathan Richman.
Join us next month for April Fool's and the run-up to our big NPR 40th anniversary shindig. Now, I know we don't usually feature even decades, but this is a big one. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.